sitting of Parliament, Friday, 18th of October, 2013. Answers to all questions continue. Question 613, the Honourable S. M. Vieira.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister for Traffic say what he plans to do to address the daily parking misery for working Voltaire?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government's sustainable traffic, transport and travel plan will look at parking and increased strategies aimed at trying to improve what has traditionally been a problem locally. The general consultation of this as a mission by the Honourable Member is, however, a matter of opinion, as different areas of Gibraltar have different types and levels of problems at different times of day. But what is clear is that any misery which has been experienced stems from long before 9th December 2011 and will likely be reviewed where appropriate by the implementation of the findings of a disciplinable government sustainable traffic, transport and parking plan.
Mr. Speaker, since the new dawn, all that we've heard in the context of traffic is that the sustainable traffic and transport plan will be the magic pill that solves all the problems. This is not the case, Mr. Speaker, that work on Commonwealth Park has certainly not assisted in dealing with this parking misery.
Mr. Speaker, on the contrary, if you look at actual parking and statistics, if you look at the parking that was lost at the Commonwealth Park, there was over 342 spaces lost at the Commonwealth Park. Now, what happened was that across the Commonwealth Park, provision was made for this, and now there are spaces of actually 360. So, in fact, there's been a net gain in parking. Apart from that, there's also been 17 spaces over and above the 360, which have been allocated for pay and display, allowing people who want to go to work or want to go to any of the leisure places around Queen's Quay, for example, can do so.
I see, Mr. Speaker, yes, but indeed, whether the fact that the parking has been provided now doesn't change the fact that Commonwealth Park and the work relating to it have caused significant difficulties for drivers every day. But, Mr. Speaker, will the Honourable Minister say whether it is intended to deal with anything to do with traffic to try and address what is a daily parking misery for working people saying, despite what you might say, before Mrs. McDonald provided with any kind of suggestions or recommendations?
Mr. Speaker, the only thing I have to realise that yes, the cover car park is under construction, but the rest of parking was mitigated. In fact, there's been a net increase in parking spaces. We can say that, and obviously, it would be ideal to have had Commonwealth Park and have had the other car park. That's just not possible. I mean, we've got, this is not possible, but what has happened is there has been a net increase. So, if you compare parking now, to before the 9th of December, there has been an increase in parking space. Now, as to the second part, the government has invested in a consultant which is there for this purpose, to give advice and as to where we go from here. There are many things that we have already on the pipeline and that we haven't, but of course there are loads of things that need to be done, which were there before the 9th of December. For I'll give you an example, I mean, the Trafalgar interchange is not basically with the pedestrian in mind. There's actually no concern with the pedestrian. That is something this government is very, very conscious of, and that is something this government intends to improve upon and to correct.
Mr. Speaker, it's interesting that the Minister should today say that the Trafalgar interchange is one of the GFD initiatives, not surprisingly, that they're seeking to review at some point, when previously in sessions in the House, he had said that was something that would be decided once the Sustainable Traffic and Transport Plan was created. But be that as it may, Mr. Speaker, what would he say to the suggestion that the reality post the new dawn will be that the park will be on one footprint of prime real estate in Gibraltar, and the two levels of tracking that were part of that manifesto commitment will now be on two other equally large footprints of primary estate in Gibraltar.
The Honourable Minister does not have to answer this question because he's been asked to express an opinion.
I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker. In relation to parking generally, we heard yesterday as well that the new parking that was announced by the beach that was in pursuance of a manifesto commitment for 300 parking spaces will now in fact have 440. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say how he reconciles all these promises and partial deliveries of some parking, a lot of which is needed, with the environmental status that this government holds in such apparent high regard?
I'm not entirely sure what the Honourable Gentleman is referring to in terms of the environment aspect of it, and if you can be more specific.
Mr. Speaker, there's no issue of being more specific. The question is really rather clear, and that is how the Minister reconciles the manifesto commitment and cost of delivery of all these car parking spaces with the environmental safeguard that this government holds in such apparent high regard. Mr. Speaker, if I may. These things are not mutually exclusive. Absolutely not. The new car parks, for example, will all be fitted with charge points for electric vehicles, and we have already led the way in the government fleet by having our own hybrid and electric vehicles, as we have seen recently. And clearly, increasing parking spaces will help in the day-to-day, but that does not mean that the government will carry on encouraging the use of public transport, as we saw yesterday here, that we are looking at a new bus fleet and an increasingly efficient bus service. In fact, it would be good to have more parking spaces because then we can use public transport and we can leave our cars parked and not burning fuel. Yes, Mr. Speaker, it is indeed very interesting. But the bulk of the parking spaces that you're planning to do are in the city centre. And that is what is so incongruous. And that is what I am asking the government to reconcile with our environmental filter.
Mr. Speaker, in fact, most of the car parks in the centre of town were actually car parks built by the members across the road. I mean, they started building engineers doing car park, and they started building the Theatre Royal car park. And the fact that we decided to build a car park at Queensway, I mean, it's something which we thought was very important, was vital, as you rightly said, we started to say the misery of local people. But we cannot force people put guns to head and say they cannot use their cars. We can actually shut in cars and not use their cars by way of, in fact, use public transport, including on public transport, including on other methods, in other ways. But what we can't tell people, you can't use your cars. So hence, you need to have some facility for them to park in town.
And Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say how they have improved public transport from what they inherited in December 2011? Much as he claims that this is what that they should be doing. The fact of the matter is, Mr. Speaker, that we were not the party with the so-called environmental filter. We were not the party that offered twice the number of parking spaces on site at Commonwealth Park. And that is the difference between that party on that side of Bent and this party here.
Mr. Speaker, if we across the floor on this side of the House, we are very aware that it was this party which we have been finding the place to have. In fact, one of the only things done by members across the floor was the very last thing to get the bikes on the road. I mean, and the bikes have been, as we've explained, have given us problems from start. So, and that was as much as we can't the environment by the peace administration. I mean, this government is clear. I mean, no one can deny the fact that this government, you know, has looked into not only changing the fleet of vehicles with standard new G1s, the totally electric vehicles. We've got a hybrid in the government fleet. My colleague explained earlier, and as the next question we'll touch upon, all our car parks can. And we have the infrastructure needed to provide electric infrastructure. The infrastructure systems will be there. So, in future, anybody wishes to buy an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrids, we wouldn't do so. I mean, that is a very positive step for the environment.
Honourable members are beginning to debate now. The purpose of question time is to elicit information or to press the government to take a certain line of action, but not to debate different policies.
Question 614, the Honourable S.M. Zagara.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister for Traffic say whether there are any plans for the provision of electricity charging bays in local car parks for the use of electrical hybrid plug-in vehicles?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, charging points for electric and hybrid charging vehicles have been provided in the Angels Lane and Rangers Palace multi-story car park. These were not part of the original design but were added to cater for users of said car park acquiring these types of vehicles in the future. Charging points are also being installed in the new car park currently under construction at South Pavilion. The improvement of air quality is one of the objectives of the government's sustainable traffic and transport and parking plan, and greater use of environmentally friendly vehicles would contribute towards this. The provision of more charging points is therefore something that is being considered for new parking facilities to be developed in the future. Mr. Speaker, as a proportion of all the parking spaces that the Minister has referred to in engineers and around the palace and the new car park at Sutherland Road, is he able to say what proportion of those parking spaces will have that facility?
Mr. Speaker, the infrastructure seems to be laid for the whole parking. So although you can't see charging points there and then, and we're not going to place or install expensive charging facilities in all the parking bays when people at this moment in time have not got electric vehicles or have no intention of buying them at the moment. But the actual infrastructure, the cabling, is there. So in the future, if people wish to have an environmentally friendly vehicle, they can just, that can be, arranged in a suitable structure, can be placed in that parking bay in question.
Question 615, the Honourable S.M. Zagara.
Can the Honourable Minister of Traffic say whether provision will be made in any of the new housing estates of electricity charging points for vehicles in the development of parking areas?
Answer the Honourable Minister of Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 620 and 621.
Question 620. 620 on
what EJ Wendy. Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Housing provide details of all tender bids received in the federal government through new housing projects as recently announced?
Question 621, the Honourable Egan Henry.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many houses would be for sale and how many for rental in the state of government's new housing project has recently announced?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, tenders were invited on the 7th of December 2012 for the development of the area farm site for an affordable housing scheme. Similarly, tenders were invited on the 5th of February 2013 for a development of the Coates Park site, again for an affordable housing scheme, although in this instance, it included one building for rental for the elderly. Both tenders were evaluated following the principles and requirements set out by EU and Gibraltar legislation in respect of public procurement. This resulted in the area farm tender being awarded to DJDS and the Coates Park tender to Kasai. The area farm affordable housing scheme will be for sale, and this consists of a total of 564 flats comprising 38 one-bedroom flats, 166 two-bedroom flats, 321 three-bedroom flats, and 39 four-bedroom flats. The majority of the flats of Coates Park site will also be part of the affordable housing scheme. This consists of 380 flats comprising 65 one-bedroom flats, 143 two-bedroom flats, 152 three-bedroom flats, and 20 four-bedroom flats. The 65 one-bedroom flats will be provided for rental for the elderly. Adequate parking provision will be provided within both estates, and this will include the provision of electricity charging points for vehicles.
Peter, can I please clarify a little point there? I think that the minister, to my mind, said that there are 380 flats being built at the coast, but, and he said the majority would be for sale. Am I right in deducing that our number 65 for rental, which I think is earmarked for the elderly, all the rest remain for sale, or some of the remainder that are not for the elderly are also for rental? Mr. Speaker, yes, I did say that 380 flats were being built, and that the 65 one-bedroom flats that I mentioned will be provided for rental for the elderly. The rest are low-cost homes in the state. So, Mr. Speaker, I still have a mind about other number 65 rentals that seem to be suitable for the elderly. All the others will be for sale, and therefore no rental for those of the general housing waiting list. Mr. Speaker, as mentioned, there are 65 one-bedroom flats which are provided for rental within this estate. It is obviously assumed that many of the persons who intend to will take over these flats, when there's a big demand for these flats, will relinquish their own flats, which means that we will have, you know, an amount of flats which will go back into the housing stock. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In respect of question number 620, I asked for details of all tender bids received. I have not heard that, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this is as given the honourable gentleman, that the two tenders, one was awarded to DJBS, and that was the one at the AFR, and the coach truck was awarded to Kasai. And the rest of that information is public knowledge, that's already been released. Mr. Speaker, can the minister please guide me, because I posed the question because I wasn't able to find this under publicly available documents. What I want is details of all the tenders received. Not just a successful, the name of a successful tender. I want to know, you know, company X, Y, Z, and what the bid was, and so on. If it is a public document, then can it please be directed in the right location?
The Honourable Minister doesn't have information within his hands. I could say that.
I think the honourable member may not have all the detailed information with him. But the practice has been and will continue both under the previous administration and I think historically since procurement commenced in Gibraltar by way of tender, that the information given is the information of the successful tender and the amount in which they did, and also the number of tenderers who submitted to. I don't think that we've ever given, and when I say we, the government, and not necessarily this government, we've never given the details of who else tendered and what the amount of their submission for tender was. I don't believe that information has ever been given. In any event, Mr. Speaker, whilst we check that, because it has been given before, for no reason why it's been given again, but I believe it isn't given, in any event, the honourable gentleman will know that in European tendering, and both of these were European tenders, there is a period when appeals can be made by those who are not successful. And for that period, certainly, which we are still in, as I understand it, we wouldn't be disclosing the names and amounts of those others who might have submitted tenders. So there's two issues, if you're allowing. First of all, checking whether that is information that is ever disclosed, other than the number of attenders, and second, the time when it could be disclosed when you're dealing with a European tender, which may be after the period for filing appeals, etc., has passed. I think that time will pass probably by the end of this month. It's a short appeal period of about 30 or 60 days. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, for that clarification. Yes, I said that the Minister would like to check that information. Can I add that if it is a case that it has not been disclosed before, he may well wish to consider you know, and make that information available now. But I do understand what the seniors are saying, that there has to be a period for a period and so on. Is the government at least able to say how many tender bids were received? Just as a double figure, you know, whether just one tender or five tenders, how many tender bids were received in respect of each of the projects?
Mr. Speaker, I think that there shouldn't be any difficulty telling the general how many have been received, but I don't think that would affect any appeal process. And it may be, Mr. Speaker, that we need to make the decision, and I'll go back and check, that even if we, again, the government, not just this government, but as far as we've been for tender procurement began, do not give out the information in the Parliament, because of course there are commercially sensitive aspects about prices that people may have put up. Some people may have a lower price, but they may be disqualified because they fail to comply with part of the tender, and that's why their price may be lower. So all sorts of issues like that. It may be that even if we make the decision that that information cannot be shared across the floor of the House, there may be no difficulty sharing it behind the Speaker's chair as long as there is a confidentiality accepted, and therefore there isn't any commercial issue with members of the opposition having the information and then sharing it with some of the unsuccessful tenders. Those are the issues that we can look at. I'm quite happy to go back and check. My feeling is we've never shared the information. And what I'll do is, before I sit down, I'll give way to the Minister so that he can give the information that he has it of the numbers of tenders we submitted to tenders.
Mr. Speaker, if you look at the Eurofund tender, there's a total of 7 tenders which were accepted, which were submitted, and for the Coast Park tender site, there were 12. Now, I must say that it doesn't necessarily follow that there are 12 different companies or 7 different companies. Some companies may choose to make different offers for the same project.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman said that we need to look at the practice, and the practice in the past has been by the GOC government that this information has been provided, that the government needs to provide it. I think really that shouldn't really be a consideration. I mean, at the end of the day, the government now makes decisions as to whether to disclose information or not to disclose information. Now, I quite understand, irrespective of what has been the historical practice, I quite understand that there may be reasons and valid reasons why not to disclose the identity of all of them. And I can think of a number of reasons why not to, but that has to stand independently of what the practice has been in the past. But can I ask you this? Have these two tenders, the successful tenders, been the most economically advantageous tenders that the government has accepted out of the 7 and the 12, by which I obviously mean that they have come in at a lower price than the others, or have these successful tenders been, you know, they may not have been the lowest price, but there may have been other reasons why the government has accepted, because I accept as well that in some cases it may well be there may be valid reasons why the government may accept one tender above another, even though that wasn't the lowest price tender.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman didn't think that my government is going to be constrained by the things his government did. He knows that we have departed from the practice in myriad instances when we think that the practice of the previous administration or administration has not been the one to follow now. V-Day, monthly meetings of Parliament, transmitted live on television and the internet. Where there is a good reason for departing from practice, we depart from it. V-Day, public meetings of the Development and Planning Commission. So that is not going to be the issue. But where the Honourable Members were pursuing, for example, a policy of previous
administrations themselves when they were in government. And I say plural because, as I've indicated, this may be a practice going back to 1977 when the Procurement Act was first introduced. But there may be a very good reason for that, and that is why I don't want to depart from that practice without understanding what the reasoning was. If it was just really gave me credit. If it was just the secretive practice of the GSD government from 1996 to 2011, well, that's not going to be a reason for us to continue with the practice. But if this is something, as I suspect, that comes from the beginning of public procurement in Gibraltar, for competitive reasons in the market, where you don't necessarily want to show other people's prices to the whole of the market, then that practice is going to continue. That's why I've opened the door slightly ajar to the possibility of sharing information with members of the opposition and not necessarily sharing it across the floor of the House, which is another possibility which I'm not committing myself to, because I have to understand whether that is mine. The effect of opening more widely the sharing of information. Mr. Speaker, in terms of whether these were the economically most advantageous tenders that were submitted, I consider that they certainly would have been without even looking at the prices, because that is what the criteria established by the tender board when tenders were put out is set out to achieve. That doesn't necessarily mean that the cheapest of the submission is the one that is chosen, because that may not be the economically most advantageous. I mean, you could have, for example, and the Honourable Mr. Alvan has pointed out that more than one submission has been filed in some instances by the same entity. So you could have a submission from one entity that offers to build X, which would produce a price of an amount per square meter, or another submission from the same entity, or another entity that offers to build so much and that produces another price per square meter. You look at them, and the price of one is higher than the price of the other on the face of it. So this might be 5 million more than this, but you get many more square meters for the extra 5 million. And so if you work it out per square meter, is that economically more advantageous? The standard of the construction proposed, the type of construction, the standard of finish proposed, all of those things can affect what you might call the bottom line price, which may be higher in one instance than in another, but still the higher price might be economically more advantageous because you get, as I said yesterday in relation to another question, more bang for your buck, even though you're paying more upfront. So all of those things is what makes up the tender criteria, and it is designed to deliver, in effect, the best value for money for the taxpayer. And in each instance, of course, the government would not have proceeded with anything other than the best value for money for the taxpayer. Yes, Mr. Speaker, of course, I could be forgiven for the comments that I made in preamble to my question, because of late, the government, got a lot of constitution, the tripartite talks, has been quite key in taking GSD clothes and adopting GSD policy. But Mr. Speaker, it can be Honourable the Chief Minister perhaps help us as to whether the price at which these tenders came in were the cheapest, and if they weren't the cheapest, can he give us an explanation, a reason, why the government preferred these two tenders above the other tenders, why they were more economically advantageous to the government in the diocese? No, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to provide that sort of information at this stage, because I'm going to go back and check what the practice was, because even by disclosing whether these are or are not the cheaper, I may be offending that practice, which is a GSD practice which I now appear to be offending, and I want to understand what the rationale behind that was before I decide to change it in any way, even if I'm just going to be saying that they were the cheapest or they were not the cheapest. But look, by the next House, I will have a chance to check. So if we ask them, we can be in a position to share that information, if it is shareable or otherwise. But Mr. Speaker, the reasoning I have already explained. In the event that these were not the cheapest bottom line figures, then they would certainly have been
the most economically advantageous for the government and therefore the most value for money for the taxpayer. Nixon was involved, I assume, in tendering when he was dealing with the court development, which, having checked, actually went up from 7 odd to 12 million. That didn't go up to tender, and perhaps we have some questions to ask about that. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, it's always about getting the best value for the taxpayer. There's no question of us doing it in any other way. Finally, Mr. Speaker, it is true that the Honourable Gentleman has spent the better part of the last 2 weeks putting foot directly in mouth in respect of a number of different issues. One of them relating to the government's attitude to the Constitution, another the government's attitude to the Cold of Affairs and the Tripartite Forum. He doesn't seem to understand the fine differences between us and them on those issues and our attitude. Perhaps I can illustrate it to him in a way that is stark enough that even he will understand. We will never adopt the previous government's
Constitution, Mr. Speaker, that it is really necessary dealing with questions on housing and electricity parking points to go into the whole question of the tripartite process.
Mr. Speaker, I apologize for having fallen into the trap laid for me so blatantly by the leader of the opposition, who did feel that it was necessary to talk about Goldwater, the tripartite, and the Constitution when dealing with housing. I don't let it happen again. Thank you so much for pulling me up on it.
Wonderful, Mr. Speaker, is not any supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I've looked quickly at the questions in relation to the housing development, and if I've missed it, I do apologise. But is there a contract time frame, contract date, or is there an estimate of when the housing project are expected will be completed?
The plan that we housing in the state will be finished before the next election to be able to deliver it on our manifesto commitment.
Mr. Speaker, I can come back to
what I was asking in 620 and 621. The minister provided me the information that he said he provided at that moment in respect of the Oval Farm and the Coast Park development. However, there is no reference to another recently announced government housing project, which is that around the Unicorn Avenue area, with another figure that it was awarded for 8.9 million to build 72 flats. But the minister has not told me whether those are going to be for rental and for sale and so on.
Thank you, Mr.
Speaker. Was actually mentioned in the statute issued yesterday, and that is an estate which is for government rental, and it is government rental for the elderly. I might have blamed the figure because the press release did not say whether they were prepared for rental. It did mention the elderly, but the elderly are entitled to purchase as a whole.
Question 616, the Honourable E.J. Zayas.
Further to the answer to question number 331 of 2013, can the Minister for Housing now provide this House with details of the comprehensive review which government is undertaking of the Housing Works Agency and the Ministry for Housing?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, previously advised, the internal report was passed to cabinet and is still under consideration. Does the Minister of the State have any idea when that consideration will be concluded?
No, Mr. Speaker. Question 617, the Honourable E.J. Reyes.
Further to the answer provided to question number 472 of 2013. Can the Minister for Housing provide details of actions taken in order to prepare in non-compliance of house rules at Mid Harbour Estate?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services. Mr. Speaker, prior to my answer to question number 472 of 2013, I am pleased to inform the following. The tenders for the CCTV cameras have already been awarded and work for the installation of these commenced. The installation of barriers at the entrance and entry points of the guards are also at an advanced stage. The tender for these has also been awarded and works are ongoing. We continue to work closely with the RGP who are patrolling the area. And in respect of, if I understood it correctly, the CCTV camera, the tender has been received, so the Minister confirmed that it is still undergoing the tender analysis status. And in respect to the barriers, he says that the work was advanced stage. Can he therefore say how much the tender was awarded for? And to whom?
Strictly speaking, I don't think that the details about the work through the tender arise from the previous question, from the original question, which is to provide the House with details of actions taken in order to curtail any time. That question has been answered. In the process of answering, there has been mention of a tender, but that does not arise from the original question.
I accept.
The Minister has the information at hand, and he could be to provide it by all means.
That was my intention. I accept that it is stretching a bit, but you know, the Minister may well have the information, and it says that, you know, a question next month, and it says the whole board is waiting another month just to hear the information, but he may well have at hand, and he may have no problems in providing it.
Yes, both of the tenders were awarded. The information I have with me at the moment is that the successful tender for the CCTV cameras was safe.
And that is as much as I have need at the moment, Peter. I accept that in the speaker, and thank you for allowing me the liberty, and obviously you will hint at me very strongly that I pose the wordy question for next month, basically, so the Minister even has advance notice of what I intend to speak next month.
Yes, if you're going to would like to pose a question for next session, Parliament, I'd be happy to provide any information and questions.
Question 618, the Honourable E.J. Hall.
Can the Minister for Housing provide updates of details in respect of expenditure incurred since the answer to question number 532 of 2013, in respect of contract awarded for making empty homes suitable for reallocation, stating to whom payments were made, how much has been paid, the number of residential homes pertaining to payments, as well as indicating if the sales is constructed where for repairs or cleaning?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, we now hand the Honourable Member a schedule containing information requested.
This is fine, Mr. Speaker. I take this agreement as well to thank the Minister because in last question, we managed to get at long last to the right formula of what I was thinking and so on. And I see it's been a good particular thing this month. I'm extremely grateful that this then allows me not to have to present any supplementary. So I hope to keep to this format for the future.
Question 619, the Honourable E.J. Ray.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details in respect of rental homes assigned since the answer to question number 533 of 2013, indicating how many will be repaired by A, the House
and Works Agency, B, subcontractors, and C, the assigned tenants themselves.
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer given to question number 533 of 2013, 15 sites have been assigned. The repairs are to be undertaken by the following: A, Housing Works Agency, 2, B, subcontractors, 12, C, the assigned tenants themselves, 1.
Question 622, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details in respect of all repairs undertaken to lift servicing government rental homes since the answer to question written 94 of 2013?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand the Honourable Member a schedule containing the information requested.
Now, this is a rather lengthy schedule, so I would suggest that we move on to the next question.
Question 623, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
Can the Minister for Housing provide details of how many tenants required urgent decanting from their homes since the answer to question written 95 of 2013, indicating the reason why, the date when said decanting became necessary, and the date when tenants were able to return to their homes?
And to the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, I will now hand the Honourable Member a schedule containing the information requested.
This is rather shorter, and I will allow the Honourable Mr. Reyes or any other member to ask any supplementaries arising from the case study.
My name is Mr. Speaker. In respect of tenant number 2 that required the decanting due to fire at premises, that seems to have happened towards the end of July and the works are ongoing. Does the Minister have, by chance, you know, any sort of information whether the repair works will be concluded relatively soon, or will it be a case that unfortunately has happened in the past, where we had to eventually reallocate the house on a permanent basis because the damage was so expensive? So, do we have any indication at this stage whether it's work in progress, or it seems to have been such a major thing that the tenants may have well been moved out on a permanent basis?
People with great fear actually giving a time scale. I did ask that question to my members of staff, they said that they were of the opinion that these works will be finished next week. I think that is what they told me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. What may have to happen, Mr. Speaker, is that if I do pose this question again in the future, or when information has been provided to me, or when the decanting was necessary, and so on, because I also say the date when the tenants were able to send back home, perhaps in the future, if it does end up being a schedule that tends to happen in most cases, once the work has been completed and the tenant is able to move back home, perhaps the Minister can ask the staff to ensure that that is included in the schedule, and that we actually have an audit trail of the date of the decanting and when he went to that date. It's more of an admin matter that I would like the staff to take into account. The schedule notice, I think that will cause a major headache, and I'm sure the Minister will be able to oblige.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I'm happy to oblige you every question.
Question 624, the Honourable E.J. Hayes.
The Speaker, can the Minister for Housing say how many residential homes have, since the answer to question written 96 of 2013, been A, allocated, and B, assigned, showing the room composition of the respective homes?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, since the answer to question number, the written question number 96 of 2013, 55 flats have been allocated and assigned as follows. Allocated 1 RKD, 6 in number, 2 RKD, 14, 3 RKD, 13, 4 RKD, 7, 5 RKD, 0, 6 RKD, 0. A total of 40 flats allocated. As for signs, we have 1 RKD, 0, 2 RKD, 8, 3 RKD, 4, 4 RKD, 2, 5 RKD, 1, and 6 RKD, 0. That provides a total of 15 assignments.
Next question. Question 625, the Honourable S. N. Vieira.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister for Financial Services say whether further to statements made by his colleague, the Honourable Gilbert Hughes, formerly Minister for Financial Services, during his budget address in June this year, and they take increased interest and growth in Gibraltar as a pension domicile has yielded results.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services in Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Income Tax Office has approved a total of 201 member curates in Gibraltar. We have strong indications that this number is set to multiply in the very near future. I can report that HMRC publishes a list of QOP schemes on a monthly basis. This is a list of pension schemes that have notified HMRC that they meet the conditions to be a qualified, recognized overseas pension scheme and asked to be publicly listed. At the beginning of September 2012, there were 10 such Gibraltar schemes publicly listed, whilst the current list has 23 Gibraltar schemes. Therefore, the number of publicly listed schemes has more than doubled in the last 12 months. As a result of increased QOP activity, and ahead of a further expected increase in Gibraltar QOP business. I would therefore like to take this opportunity, Mr. Speaker, to congratulate my predecessor, John Mr. Gilbert Goody, on his work as Minister for Financial Services in carving out a new and increasingly interesting area of our sector.
Question 626, the Honourable SNBL.
Can the Honourable Minister for Financial Services provide the capital further details of the, quote, new marketing management system being introduced to manage more efficiently, the wealth of contacts that have been established over time, and ensure that this area delivers effective results, and, quote, and support the government's drive to, quote, drive to increase direct marketing activity, end quote, as referred to in the budget address on financial services in June this year.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, the Finance Secretary Department has been piloting its direct electronic marketing by a system called MailChimp. MailChimp is an email marketing service provider and is used globally. MailChimp currently holds one of the Finance Center Department's databases made up entirely of email addresses that are segmented geographically and by industry segment. The system has enjoyed a reasonable rate of success and is used in parallel to hard copy marketing, Facebook and Twitter. The initiative has been managed by Paul Estengel in conjunction with other members of the Finance Center team and has been welcomed by the industry.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for the answer. One question that comes to mind as a result of the answer is whether there are any data protection issues that arise from the use of a service like MailChimp I don't know where the services are located. I do recognize the name and the service. But I wonder whether there are any issues that arise from the use of that system, or whether the minister is satisfied that all the relevant controls and certification are in place from that provider to your satisfaction.
My understanding is that there isn't an issue. An awful lot of the information there has been put on by the finance center team themselves in terms of expanding their own database. And a push is on at this moment in time to further that by contacting people around the world who are linked to Gibraltar in financial services who wish to receive information and are constantly put on the database and receive the information that is regularly passed through on developments in Gibraltar in relation to financial services.
Question 627, the Honourable
Assembly Member. Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister for Financial Services say whether recent changes to the experience and method fund regulations have yielded results for the local funds industry in the context of the establishment or the domiciliation of funds to Gibraltar, contracting or retaining the use of, quote, reputable and substantial administrative facing jurisdictions of equivalent standing to Gibraltar, end quote.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, there will be no way of purchasing with an external fund administrator during the period since the implementation of the EIS regulations on the 12th of April 2012. According to the SSC website, three external fund administrators have been approved, which are Credit Suisse Fund Services Luxembourg SA, Société Générale Security Services SESS Ireland Limited, and SIP Financial Services Ireland Limited. Since the new regulations were introduced in April of last year. I said the two applications for approval from the fund administrator outside of the board are currently standing consideration. The sector believes that the new approved administration will unquestionably lead to further activity for our local fund industry.
The regulations came in some time ago, and while certainly in certain respects in this industry something sent me as quickly as we might otherwise hope. Is the minister able to say or provide us with his insight as to why perhaps this is their own specific explanation, this might not have yielded results yet in that respect?
Mr. Speaker, for an external fund administrator to come to Gibraltar requires a certain degree of planning before that decision is taken. That decision may be taken when they believe there to be sufficient interest in that business for them to locate to Gibraltar by being licensed here. Subsequent to that, an application requires to work with the Financial Services Commission, there is a process there. So I don't believe the five and possibly six companies that are registering in Gibraltar as external fund administrators are doing so for the fun of it. There is a time element, there is a cost element, and I therefore believe that what the current ones that have registered are preparing for is to begin to move towards the funds from the system, which I believe is what we and the entire industry wish to happen, and I believe it will.
Question 628, the Honourable SNP Lord.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable the Minister for Financial Services say when proposals for legislation introducing anti-fraud statute rules, changes to the perpetuity period, private trust companies, purpose trust and foundations can be expected to be brought before the Council as part of the ongoing process of making the board more competitive and attractive trust jurisdictions?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
We are progressing the various pieces of legislation and each is at a different stage of the required process. It is expected, subject to any unforeseen issues arising, that all the main legislation will be in force at different stages, but not later than the end of the first quarter of 2014. For the avoidance of doubt, all this type of legislation will be OECD compliant from the transparency and availability of information point of view. I would therefore expect these pieces of legislation to be brought before this House over the next few months.
In terms of consultation, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say which entities bodies have been involved in that process with the government, if any of them? And I'm certainly aware that there are a couple.
as I'm sure my honourable member friend will know, the pieces of legislation, the specific ones that he referred to, were proposed by STOP, and we have obviously been working very closely with STOP in respect of this legislation, and I have met with him myself, as well as, of course, had my predecessor met with him in the interview period. These proposals were made in May 2010, when the first request was made for this legislation to be passed through. And although STOP is the principal mover of this legislation in terms of making suggestions and proposals to government, we have also discussed this with the Finance Centre Council, who represents, in effect, all the players in the financial services sector combined in that one unit. And this was discussed as recently as last week by after them in the progress that we have.
Question 629, the Honourable S.M. Vienna.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable the Minister for Justice confirm the number of vacant posts applicable to court service under step is only being taken to fill these?
Answer the Honourable the Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the number of vacant posts at the Gibraltar Court Service are as follows: 3 executive officers, 1 administrative officer, and 1 bailiff. A notice inviting applications for the post of executive officers was issued on 5th October 2013. The closing date for application is 21st October 2013. The post of bailiff was advertised internally, but there were no suitable candidates from within the service. The vacancy was further advertised on the 8th of October to government-owned companies as well as to government agencies and authorities. The closing date for applications was 15th October 2013. The recruitment process for administrative officers has not yet commenced.
Question 630, the Honourable S.M. Vienna.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister of Justice say what, if any, plans the government has for the replacement of the recently departed CEO of the Gibraltar Court Service?
Answer the Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the government's current intention is to abolish the post of the Chief Executive Officer of the Gibraltar Court Service. Pending final arrangements on the management structure at the Court Service, a senior executive officer is acting as CEO.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Minister for the answer. Is it really possible for the Minister to provide us with some insight as to the government thinking in this respect and not replacing the CEO?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I don't want to delve into a little speculation or hypothesis as to what may happen. That's why I say this is our current intention. The present Chief Executive Officer, because he's still in post, in fact, until the end of October, although he's on leave, Mr. Davis, who's incumbent, he's on leave from the 4th of October, but he is still holding the post until the end of October. He was brought in on a 3-year contract to do a specific job by the former Minister for Justice in particular, to do with the structural work that we're involved, as well as organizational issues. By and large, the job that he was working to do has been completed. The work has been completed, part of the organization has been done. There is still ongoing work on some internal issues, email, internet services, and IT issues, and something still needs to be done. And clearly, there is ongoing work. The government felt that it was not necessary to continue with an appointment of an externally appointed CEO on a contract basis. Therefore, the government's position is that there should be a management structure which will still have a head in the form of probably a senior officer of the government. So the numbers will not change. It's just that the CEO or the person heading the managing the court service ultimately will not be a contracting officer. Will be a permanently based officer at the Gibraltar Court Service.
Yes, before I ask my question, may I, on behalf certainly of this side of the house, thank Mr. Davis for the work that he has done over the last 3 years. I personally was instrumental in bringing him over. I know the size of the task that he had when he took over. It was a very, very difficult job in terms of combining the structures of the Magistrates Court and the Supreme Court, which are two separate entities, both in terms of court, but also in terms of management and how they were run into an integrated court service. And I believe that as a consequence of the job that he has done, together, of course, with the staff underneath him, the people that were there and have been there for many, many years, that the service today is much better than the service it was 3 years ago. I talk only on this side of the house because, of course, I can't presume to talk on behalf of the government in relation to this. But as I understand it, effectively, what the government is doing is just simply doing away with the role of with the post of CEO and replacing it with a senior officer so that it becomes effectively just simply a civil service structure. Because, of course, you can have a CEO, a locally appointed CEO, for example, to head the, or you can have somebody from the civil service that is also appointed CEO. But you know, as I understand it, really, other than the momentum shareholders, the structure is going to be remain more or less the same. There's going to be a head, presumably two FTOs underneath it, which is the position today. Can you just sort of clarify that? That's my understanding of it.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Before I answer the question, which is going to be the first part of what the other member has said, the government certainly acknowledges the work that Mr. Davis has done over the last 3 years, and I have, in fact, written to him and thanked him for what he has done for the debate court in the last three years. But the honourable members are exactly right. The structure will remain as it is. There may be a change in role and the name, but it won't be a contracted officer. It will be more of an internal structure, but the structure in terms of management will remain the same. We haven't made those final arrangements yet, and that's why I said the government's current intent to continue to do that. But certainly we will see no reduction in numbers, and there will still be a head of the digital court service managing and taking the responsibility for the court service.
Question 633, the Honourable E.J. Hay.
Can the Minister for Education provide details in respect of a number of students present on the agenda who are repeating subjects pertaining to GCSEs, which they have examinations for at the end of academic year 2012-2013, indicating at which educational establishment they are currently receiving revision tuition?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 634 and 635 of 2013.
Question 634.
Can the Minister of Education provide details in respect to the number of pupils who touch GCSE examinations, broken down by gender and educational establishment where they receive full time education at the end of the academic year 2012-2013?
Question 635.
Can the Minister for Education provide details? Can the Minister for Education provide details of how many students have enrolled for post GCSE education in year 12 or equivalent for the academic year 2013-2014, broken down by gender and educational establishment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
The information requested by the Honourable Member is set out in the schedule, which I now hand to you.
On conclusion of the
supplementary to these questions. I think we'll have a short recess of about 10 minutes while some paperwork is being done in connection with the motion which the Chief Minister proposes to introduce, appointing the Select Committee.
Can I ask the Minister, could a little bit of just a topographical error, but in the schedule to reply, in the answer to question 633, it says the details of the number of students broken down by gender, which is what requested, were repeating subjects pertaining to GCSE at the end of the academic year 2012-13. Can I just clarify? That is, those who did the GCSEs in academic year 12-13 and are taking it under the academic year 13-14. Is that correct? I've been pedantic in the mentions here, but I want to get it right. Yes, Mr. Speaker, the other members are entirely right. These are GCSEs which were taken at the end of last year and are now being repeated. I should say that these boys and girls are not just repeating the ones that they have chosen to repeat, which they did at the end of the academic year 2012-13. The repeat program in school involved a battle, which involved some of the subjects they didn't, and sometimes involved one or two extra subjects. With regard to the figures, the most important innovation in terms of previous years in those figures is, of course, Base High School, where previous years the answer would have been zero boys and zero girls. And we have introduced, as the Honourable Member knows, the possibility of making sure that boys and girls have the same opportunities regardless of the school they go to, and therefore the repeat option is now available in Base High School when previous years the Honourable Member knows it wasn't.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for that, and I just want to inform you so that I concur wholeheartedly with what you said. It is a very welcome innovation. obviously,
that figure of 18 boys on the base height would probably have been slightly lower and would have appeared under the column of the Gibraltar College for boys there. So it is progress, and therefore for the benefit of our students. And I thank you wholeheartedly on behalf of this side of the house for having implemented something that we were also very strongly committed to do. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I may now move the recess for 10 minutes.
I will now recess for about 10 minutes.
Suspension of standing orders. The Honourable Recusant.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with a government motion.
Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Government motion. The Honourable Recusant.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows and which has been circulated to one of the members a moment ago. That this House approves, pursuant to Standing Order 59, that the suspension of Standing Order 19, but only to the extent that in at least 5 days, exclusive of Saturday, Sunday, and public holidays, notice is required of the motion which has been notified by the Hon. Chief Minister on the 16th of October 2013 and circulated by the clerk on the 16th of October 2013.
I now put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House, acting in accordance with the motion dated the 4th of June 2013, hereby
were called to the Select Committee on Parliamentary Reform was established on that day. Recalls that the purpose of the committee was to consider the implementation of appropriate recommendations of the report produced by the Independent Committee on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform, and hereby approves the appointment of the Honourable Fabian Figueroa MP, Chairman, the Honourable Dr. Joseph Arcila MP, the Honourable Neil Costa MP, the Honourable Daniel Peterman MP, and the Honourable Damon Pastina MP to the said Select Committee. Mr. Speaker, the purpose of this motion is to start the process of the Select Committee's work. The work that will be done by the Select Committee was the subject of the discussion that the House enjoyed back in June. This is really just enabling us to start that work, to have the committee appointed, which is something that has to be done by motion under the rules. You kindly pointed out to me that the committee will also need a secretary, of course, but that secretary does not have to be appointed by motion in this House, and the committee itself can invite somebody to become its secretary. So, Mr. Speaker, for all the reasons that we debated last time, that this issue was before the floor of the, or was on the floor of the House, and all the reasons I've indicated now, I commend the motion to the House, and I want to thank the clerk for having quickly come up with the formula of words that one has to use to negotiate the maze of the parliamentary procedure at the moment, and enable us to take this motion now. You never know, the committee might make all of these things easier.
I now propose a question in return to the motion moved by the Honourable Deputy Minister. If no Honourable Member wishes to speak on the motion, I will put the question. I now put the question in return to the motion proposed by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House will now adjourn to Tuesday, the 29th of October at 9:15 in the morning.
I now propose a question, which is that this House will now adjourn to Tuesday, the 29th of October at 9:15 in the morning. I now put the question, which is that this House will now adjourn to Tuesday, the 29th of October at 9:15 in the morning. Those in favour? Those against? Passed. The House will now adjourn to Tuesday, the 29th of October at 9:15 in the morning.